Welcome to Recovery Rocks, where we talk about all things recovery and music. I'm Tawny.
And I'm Lisa, and we're really glad you're here. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Rocks. It's Lisa. Unfortunately, Tawny is not able to join us today, but she will be back very soon. And I am extremely fortunate today to have an amazing guest on to chat, and I think you guys will all really enjoy it. Our guest today is Shahjahan Khan. He is a voiceover artist, actor, and musician based in Boston. He is the current host of the King of the World podcast, exploring his life as a Pakistani American Muslim in the 20 years since 9/11. You can hear him as Mateo on Rom-Com Pod Season 1, which debuted at number 1 on Apple Fiction Podcast. Watch him as Humajan in the first ever virtual stage reading of Rajiv Joseph's Guards at the Taj, produced by Soho Shakes and directed by Kanika Vaish. And listen to his internationally acclaimed South Asian American punk band, the Kaminas, as featured in Rolling Stone, The Guardian, Paper, CNN, Mike, and anywhere you can get the internet, which sometimes out here is a little bit spotty. But welcome to Recovery Rock, Shahjahan, and I
Thank
hope
you.
I didn't butcher that.
No, you got it all, and you've reminded me I should probably update my bio. It's all still accurate. But,
yeah.
But
well,
no,
what
thank
else
you
are you doing?
Me.
Is there something you'd add?
I'm always doing a million things, you know, like it's funny. We just finished the King of the World series, obviously, and we're still kind of, we actually just won this really cool award before the end of the year. We took home best production at the Asian American Podcasters Association Award, the Golden Cranes. Super cool, man. I've never done anything. We've applied for a bunch more. So, you know, fingers crossed. We'll see what happens.
Well, I listened to it start to finish, and it is fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I loved it on so many levels. I feel like there's days to talk about it. So we may have to have you back again.
Anytime.
Yeah. But I really loved it. It's a 7-part podcast. And I think that the way you wove your story in with your family story and with the story of the American Muslim community after 9/11 was brilliant, because there were these threads that went all the way through, and it was feeling like an insight into real lived experience through the whole thing.
And I'm super lucky. I mean, our whole team at our company is called Rafaelion Media. My boss and co-producer Asad Bud, I'm indebted to him for life. But yeah, basically, when he first approached me to do this show towards the tail end of the horrendous year we all remember as 2020. And initially, I didn't want to do it because I didn't want to do something that once again centered like 9/11 in the Muslim narrative, you know, like again. And I knew again also that with it being just like the 10 year or every year, you know, around that time, it's just, I just was very hesitant, but we started to talk about how we could do it in a different kind of a way, you know, and looking at it as like a coming of age story, and that's the part that I honestly wasn't, I don't think any of us were expecting people to relate to it as much as they did. Obviously, you know, we made it with certain communities, I guess, in mind, whether it's like the Muslim community or Pakistani community, South Asian community. Definitely, I figured like maybe I hope my friends will listen to it. But since it's come out,
and the recovery community,
of course, yeah, for sure. And I was just hoping that, we were like, I hope we make one good episode at least. And then we just were so lucky because it's such a, I think, sound design element of it. And as me as like an audio nerd with music and stuff, that was one thing I just was hoping would be like good. And I think that it really turned out really well. So I just feel really privileged to be a part of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's fantastic. And, you know, I was realizing as I was listening and it really how your recovery journey tracks sort yeah. of, you know, using that as like using what happened after 9/11 as a baseline. And I was thinking about how important it was when I was listening to your story. I was on 9/11, I was 35 years old, and okay. I was just coming back to New York from a my practice marriage.
Oh wow.
I remember, so I have very vivid, clear memories yeah. of 9/11, of what happened, of what the city was like, of all the stuff that, you know, the Muslim American community went through. And I realized that so many people don't have that context at this point, that it was a real, it's learning experience. And you mention at the end that, you know, now you have a nephew who can hear your story in this way.
Yeah. 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 That was my sister, Mariam. She was like, I definitely teared up when you did that part. But yeah, no. And it's kind of like, and I think I said this in the show as well, that, you know, whether it's sort of the kind of thing that whether we liked it or not, it was basically the most significant event
right.
that would in our, you know, for all of us in different ways. But I think in terms of like maybe me and people like me, the thing that would sort of shape our identities and stuff, and how it's kind of like the yeah. most prominent thing that's thrust up there. And already as a, you know, person struggling with recovery and sort of the beginnings mm-hmm. of what was going to be kind of the depths of addiction and stuff too. Yeah, it just was all that yeah. stuff together.
And as I mentioned, I think one of the things that ran through the whole series was this relationship with your family, your parents, yeah. your sister, and you interview them throughout on the podcast.
Yeah. There, honestly, it was like such a, obviously I'm super close, you know, with my family. I've been always, obviously, as you know, it's yeah. been contentious over the years, but now we're all very close. But still, like, I think it's for anybody that hasn't maybe done something like this, I have friends that have done different kinds of audio histories or community histories. And like to sit with your in this kind of a forum, you know, where it's not just obviously like, yeah, we sit around, we hang out, we talk about stuff, but to kind of have like a list of questions that you want to ask them, stuff comes out that you like didn't know and that you didn't remember. And especially like in that first episode where I think like, yeah, I remember exactly what happened on 9/11. I remember the next day. And then it turns out I didn't remember like two pretty, you know, nuts things that happened. And that just kind of, even at this point in my life, yeah, I'm actually about to celebrate 11 years sober, clean,
in just 2 days.
But even at this point, having, you know, done the step work, having done therapy and stuff, like there's still stuff in there, maybe, you know,
always.
Like that isn't. So that was something that struck me right away from the first. I think the first interviews I did were with my friends Jay and Eric, best friends from you know, childhood, basically. And even they had a couple, you know, and we were sort of hunting for the yearbook photo of this guy that said this thing to me the day after 9/11. And the very next one, I think, was with my youngest sister, Noorjahan. And mm-hmm. yeah, just all the stuff that came out, you know, stuff about identity, like our names and stuff. And just, you know, that me and my sister used to kind of like, we both had problems with our names. The show King of the World, for people that don't know, is sort of a translation of what my name, Shah Jahan, actually means. I have a younger sister, one of my two sisters, youngest one is Noorjahan. And we both basically discovered through this interview that we had sort of abbreviated our names, which I knew, but I didn't know that she kind of pretended to be my mom in the way that I pretended to be my dad, because I was so sick of explaining my name and stuff. And so, yeah, just so many things like that yeah. throughout the whole experience.
I really identified with listening to your parents talking about what you were like sometimes when in active addiction, right? It reminded yeah. me, like, my parents, you know, also no references with, you know, AA or recovery or getting sober. They had one friend who
yeah.
was, you know, and he was like the sober guy. And, yeah. you know, everybody knew he didn't drink. But other than that, so they didn't, you know, when they would talk, when we would talk about this stuff, you know, it was like they were learning the language too of all of addiction and recovery. And they came when I spoke on my second anniversary. They actually came to hear me qualify in a meeting.
Awesome. Yeah.
And it was so funny because, you know, people are telling their stories and I told my story. I did my qualification. Yeah. And then, you know, people were saying things around that I could only be thinking about them. Like one of my friends was like, I really identified with your story a lot. When I first met you, I thought maybe white wine, but then I learned that girl really loved her cocaine. Sitting there with my parents, like, oh my God. But,
yeah,
you know,
no, and for sure. And some of the stuff I wasn't able to, you know, obviously you can't talk about everything, but so, you know, I mean, we do actually have some addiction and stuff in my family in Pakistan, you know, and stuff that people just like didn't want to talk about, but pretty much not as soon as, but when I was a little bit, I think we were able to be a little bit more open with what was going on with me. I sort of learned a little bit more about, oh, that uncle that I don't kind of see anymore, you know, that there's something going on with him. And it's too bad that maybe, you know, people weren't able to kind of, you know, but
yeah. And I mean, there's this, this issue that I think, you know, is really at the heart of the stories that you're telling, the multiple layers throughout the podcast of stigma and its awful impact, you know, and there is this liberation that I found in being able to have my parents sitting at that meeting and know that they were still going to be proud of me. And that that was like, you know, a good thing, being able to be my true self, honest self with them, which I was never until I got sober, because I wasn't myself as I know myself now.
Of course. Yeah. And I think that I heard this, a couple of months ago on on Mark Maron's podcast. He's pretty open about recovery and stuff. And he put it really well, where he was like, you know, like we do live in this time where, we are talking about things a lot more. Right. But it's still, and I'm obviously probably not saying it as well as he did, but, it's still kind of through the lens of like, well, yeah, that stuff exists, but it couldn't be me. Right. It couldn't be anybody that I know. You know what I mean? So people are kind of like, mental health and everything and like recovery. But sometimes it's still, we're not at the point where it's that much like, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
When I speak at law firms, I will always, you know, because it's like this huge problem in the legal profession, like 20% of lawyers struggle with some kind of substance use problem. And I'll go to the firm and they'll be like, we know this is a huge issue and it's so important that you're speaking. I'm so glad you're doing it. You know, we don't have that in this office, you know? And it's like, you know.
Or even, you know, there's like physician support groups out there and you know, the amount of like doctors and
it's
stuff
everywhere.
Like that.
It's nothing, you know, I feel like there's a lot. I feel like it's important. That's why it's so important for everybody to hear these stories that we tell, because it's only by sort of raising our hands and saying, this is me, you know, this is what it looks like, this is what addiction can look like. And, you know, their recovery is possible. And, you know, could you have ever imagined before, they say in recovery that you get a life beyond your wildest dreams.
Yeah.
And could you have ever imagined your life today before?
Right. Yeah. And I think that, I know that for me, I have kind of been a pretty public person about stuff for a long time. And I know that that's not the case for everybody. And, you know, I get that element, but I think that, for me, it's just like, it's the only way to just kind of put it out there. Cause if I'm the kind of person that like, it just will just sit in my head otherwise. And I just have to say stuff, you know, and what, you know, cause but I do get that it's, you know, like I'm somebody that like, I think the last kind of day job type thing that I had, I mean, it ended up being at a company that studies, you know, addiction and stuff. And I think I just throw it out there right away. I'm like, listen, like I'm fucking sober or whatever. Like, I hope that's cool. And cause I just, you know, it's not something that I hide at all, but that's just me, you know, and I kind of, I get that it's not something that everybody can do, you know?
Yeah.
Although I will say, with this King of the World show, I really put it all out there. Like, it's funny, just like you saying, like, so many people are like, the funniest story I have about that, I think, is there's this other podcast called Mommying While Muslim, a really cool show, and just obviously about Muslim moms. And they reached out, and you know, we did a thing on that fireside chat thing. It's kind of like what is it called, Clubhouse. But one of the hosts of that show happened to be in town in the Boston area because she has relatives here. And she was like, let's totally meet up. But listen, I really want to meet your parents. Like, it was almost like they wanted to meet them more than me. And my, you know, so I was trying to figure out a place where everybody could eat and stuff. And my parents don't like to drive into the city. And so my mom was like, I'll just throw a dinner at our place. You can just invite them all over. And, you know, she came, but she basically spent the night talking to my mom.
Yeah, like,
it wasn't
even,
and I love that because, it, you know, yeah, the story, the whole story is like the story of my family more. Obviously, like, I'm the narrator and it's like centered around me, but I'm not. All of these other pieces of everything are, you know, such a part of it. And I think in recovery too, if you're fortunate, like I have been, like a lot of us are, but so many of us aren't, you know, that don't have that, the tireless support, you know, around us.
Right.
That's
totally.
Definitely something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I felt like kind of because I was that fortunate to have the people around me, my family, my friends support me, that I felt like it was more important for me to speak up because I could, because I wasn't
going to
like
have the first one to talk about it in your family type deal or.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We knew that my grandfather died from it. And
that, okay.
But that, and my mother does not talk about her father, and that is
gotcha.
Whole other story, but it's all locked away. And so, but in our immediate circle and certainly on my dad's side, and nobody, and we have a big extended family, and you know, there are people who have it but have not ever faced it and talked about it. But yeah, I think I felt more like it was important for me to do that because I knew I wasn't going to get blowback at home, and a lot of people couldn't be as public and still can. But that made me feel like, you know, even more like I want to do it.
Yeah.
The other thing there's so much I love, but I'm going to keep it on a couple of things. So relapse is a part of your story, right?
Yeah.
And so many of our listeners, you know, have, it's a part of so many people's story in recovery. And you told yours, I thought, in one of the, it's just such an effective way of, you know, sort of your, you can tell that it's come, and obviously, talk about it, not me, but like it's coming up, and then it culminates in this taking that first like drag of weed, and and you said your immediate thought was, oh fuck, right? And I think that so captures what I, you know, what I hear from other people about relapse, and I really think that the judgment around relapse is part of what keeps too many people from coming back. You know, they say, you know, facing the people in their group or something like that. And it's really the opposite about how we should view it. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about relapse and all of that.
Yeah, look, I mean, so I mean that in that particular, so I also, for people that haven't heard the show, I've been playing in this kind of punk rock band for almost 20 years now. So all of this, At a point, we started this band kind of in my early to mid 20s, and that sort of took over, and I found some success with that. And it was something that I kind of was hiding in, you know, but I was kind of like trying to stay sober and stuff on my own. But basically, like the first experience I ever had really with any kind of recovery type program was around the age of 19 after a suicide attempt. That was when I think I went to my first AA or NA meeting or that kind of thing. And I'm somebody that, like, I think it's cool that we live in a time where there are so many other like options and stuff out there for people. I think that, like, as far as relapse and stuff goes, like, I think one thing that I also wish that there could be a little less shame around it. You know, I think that it's one of those things that, like, at the end of the day, like, things are different for people. And I think that that's one thing, at least, and I'm not saying this about all recovery communities or whatever. I think that there can be, especially in some of the 12-step based stuff, a sort of a, depending on who you talk to, like a one size fits all type thing, which I don't think is as, I just don't think it's necessarily the way to go. Now, I'm somebody that still, I would still recommend going. You know, like people ask me all the time, how did you do it? I was like, well, listen, it's this weird balance between doing shit that you just don't want to do and forcing yourself to do stuff and building new routines and meeting new people and all this stuff. And you can intellectualize things as much as you want, but you kind of like have to take action and do all this. But like, yeah, you kind of have to have this balance between that, but also sort of respecting where people are coming from. And I certainly don't have all the answers there, but I do know that in my case, I was definitely fortunate enough to be welcomed back. Like when I was like ready, you know, I still had sort of the first kind of meetings I went to back in the day, I sort of had one foot in, one foot out type deal. And then when I was kind of ready to come back and commit to it, I did. And I, you know, and I did for 3-4 years, probably everything you do, you're supposed to do and all that. And I still, while I don't necessarily identify with them all the time, you know, I'm still super close with people in recovery. And like, I'm still very in touch with sponsors and stuff. And so, but yeah, so for me, like it and I also, in terms of like my own thing, was mostly like a cannabis addiction, which is a whole other topic. You know, I think especially in this time where, yeah, it's like everything's like happening around it. And I'm kind of like, yeah, I totally support it being legal, but I just like, I always give it the caveat of like, look, like I'm just someone who just can't do it. I don't care. You know, like if you like are doing that instead of heroin, like more power to you, you know, like but yeah, so there's so many little things in it. You know what I mean? That like, and that's kind of like the beauty of it. It's also some of the challenge of it. But at the end of the day, like I can tell my story, you know, and I'm trying my best to like represent one. It's a tricky thing, right? I don't want to claim that I'm representing every Muslim American Pakistani post 9/11 experience or every, you know, sobriety journey or recovery journey, but there is value. And I think like there's stuff that people can hopefully identify with in my story. That was a really long answer to a very simple question that you asked me.
No, it wasn't. And it totally ties in with sort of this related topic of there being multitude of paths to recovery, right?
Like,
I mean, you're 11 years, I'm 17 and a half. When I got sober, it was AA or nothing. Like there was no community outside. There was no online community. Yeah. I tried reading books, you know, but I was in 12 step and I stayed because it helped me so much. And I still do 12 step, but I completely get that other people are going to have, it's not for everybody. And it doesn't,
and there's still, there are still elements of it that I still, you know, to this day are very foundational parts of me, you know, like for sure.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's sort of the take what you need and leave the rest idea that they talk about in AA, but also like just that if, you know, Tawny, my podcast partner has never been an AA person, yet we land on the same, in the same place based.
Are you both on the West Coast now or are you?
No, I am. I moved from New York to Southern California in 2019 and Tawny's still in New York.
Okay. So yeah, that's interesting. So for me, I mean, one thing that happened in this past, actually during the COVID thing. So and I talked about this in the podcast too, like around year 5 or 6 for me, I started to sort of notice the lack of diversity thing in my spaces that I was in. And that's just sort of a function of like where I was in Massachusetts. You know, that's not the case. I remember being on tour once and going to a meeting on Venice Beach and being like, whoa, this is so fucking wild. Yeah, this is amazing. Yeah. And then also like, I eventually went to a meeting in Pakistan and it blew my mind, you know, but that kind of, and it was around 2015, 2016, when there was a lot of other shit happening in this country and all of these other issues that you sort of put aside for the sameness sake of the, like, we're all just trying to fucking survive here. At some point they do come back, you know? And one thing that was kind of cool in the last year I did, and I do sometimes dip into these sort of POC recovery spaces, which have cropped up on Zoom, which have been super cool. But yeah, it's cool to see it evolving and you know, and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And it's, yeah, I think the more that it evolves, the more, you know, appeal it will have to, you know, to everybody. Like there's just, you know, Tawny, for example, you know, does a lot with road recovery. I don't know. She's not, she doesn't do 12 step, but she does road recovery. And I think you would love road recovery. It is, it's a bunch of sober musicians, rock star kind of people.
What?
Yes. You have to Google road recovery.
Road recovery. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure you should, you might want to get involved in some way, but it's obviously it's not 12 step, but what it is a bunch of, musicians, in recovery, as part of their recovery, they bring at-risk teens into the studio, pretty much. And they do like a group support meeting, just a support meeting, not you know, program. And then they record and they perform. Like we've gone.
That is amazing.
And they have had artists like, they've had Slash has been in for stuff.
Amazing. There is an organization here in Boston called Right Turn, which I used to go and they used to have these artists and recovery meetings. It was started by Woody, the drummer from that band, the Del Fuegos.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And so they were actually instrumental in my first couple of years, getting, this in, you know, in 2011, 10, I started a band with guys in recovery there. And, but oh, that, I'm going to write this down, or maybe you guys could send this.
I'm going to send it to you, and I'll copy Tawny because Tawny's very close to them and very connected.
Amazing.
So yeah. It's like all this stuff out there that was never there before. And I feel like it just, every door we open, you know, can open five more. So I think that's really, really important. So now we're really like, tell everybody about the Caminas and how the Caminas happened.
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, the band I'm in, K-O-M-I-N-A-S, the Caminas. We are like South Asian, American-ish indie punk rock band that started in a garage, as many bands do. Around 2005, sort of in the Lowell, Wayland kind of area here in Massachusetts. That's where we all sort of got together. And we formed as a sort of, you could argue, not just post 9/11, but we were in that context for sure, like a post 9/11 band of brown dudes, like making punk music. And we toyed with a lot of different themes related to, yes, Islamophobia, but also like to Bollywood, to, you know, with lots of different stuff. And we kind of started on myspace.com and like we started to get attention there. It's been this like, it's been 18 years now. We're still an indie, you know, we were never on like a label or anything, but
you had a lot. I mean,
we've gotten to tour all over the world. We've done festivals and stuff, and we've been like also a cool sort of exercise in like community building and meeting other kind of fringe kids like us on the way. So we've got four or five albums out there, a bunch of music videos. Definitely like, we don't hold back in terms of like talking about the shit that pisses us off. It's something that's been a huge part of my life. Definitely something that I thought was gone when things were quite bad, you know, like, so I basically, my first big and real relapse was after we had gotten ourselves to play, our first like European tour, this big festival called, Meltdown. And, at the end of this month long tour, I had this really bad relapse, and we had just like done this live session at the BBC and had all this like cool stuff happening. And it was supposed to be like the best time in my life. And yeah, the band was kind of ready to move to New York and like start our own label and do stuff because people were hitting us up. But I just was kind of in one of the darkest and in the dark before the dawn, like literally the last 6 months of, this is 2010, were super tough. You know, I was kind of not showing up for gigs and not reliable. And then I just had, it kind of, I didn't get sober by choice. It kind of, I had to do it. Like, I ran out of money and friends and fucking relationships and stuff. And so early 2011, I was not officially kicked out of the band, but definitely they just kept going. So I was like, fuck, what the hell am I going to do now? So anyway, but so I took about 2 or 3 years off. They kept going without me. They were like better. I was so jealous. I was like, oh, God damn it. I'm pretending I'm fine because I'm, you know, I'm going to meetings. I have my other like recovery band thing going on. But deep down in my fourth step, the, you know, bandmates are at the top of the resentment list, you know, and they're the first, one of the first kind of amends that I did after the family too. But no, I'm really fortunate to have been asked to come back. I had eventually kind of went back to school. I started doing a master's degree in psychology, and after having, you know, dropped out 3-4 times, as I'm sure many, many of us, perhaps many of the people listening to this podcast know all about, dropping out of shit. But yeah, and I just kind of came back with a vengeance. And then the last, between 2014 and I'd say 2017, 18, did more again than I ever thought I would. Beyond Your Wildest Dreams.
Beyond, you know, we played Your Wildest Dreams.
Played in Morocco, did all sorts of amazing things. And now, in the last couple of years post-COVID, I've started a couple of other musical projects as well. So I've got a bunch of exciting stuff. So this year, there's a buddy of mine down in Providence. His name is Rafay Rashid. He plays in this band called Ravi Shavi. And him and I, he's actually, we sort of connected. I was down there doing some voiceover work. And we were like, hey, we're both guitar. We used to tour back in the day. And it's like, hey, we're both guitarists. Maybe we should, you know, like jam. And so we did that and we just clicked.
I've been going
down every week. I started a music project with him and actually two of the guy, one of the drummer of the band Deer Tick, who was also from Providence. So we're working on one thing. Then I'm in Rafay's other band, Ravi Shavi. We toured with Deer Tick this summer. While you could still do gigs, you know, it's kind of tenuous right now. But yeah, point being, like, dreams that I didn't even know that I wanted.
That's
have come.
The thing,
you
right?
You know what I mean? That's like, it's really, if you take a look back on where I was on January 4th. So today's January 3rd that we're doing this interview. On January 4th of 2011, I had stolen my mom's car. I had, you know, bought a bunch of shit and had nobody to like do it with. And I just, it was the saddest, but like, not like kind of like a ultra jackpot kind of day. I was still living very comfortably at my parents' suburban home in Boxborough, Massachusetts. But you know, I was like, I was a mess. I was not, nobody knew if I was coming or going type deal. And I basically almost got arrested that night. And that's kind of what brought me back in. You know, the desperation thing. It wasn't that I hadn't tried it before. It wasn't that I had much lower lows in life. It was just something about, I almost got arrested a few weeks later. I still hadn't gone to a meeting. I remember this. I actually haven't told this story in a while. I usually tell it on my anniversary, but like, I'm in a Home Depot with my mom buying a toilet because my parents need a new toilet. And I'm just like, how did this happen? Like, 6 months ago, I was in fucking London, like playing a, you know, concert and like doing shit that I always dreamed of doing. And now my life is like this big,
How
did this?
Yeah.
And then I sent a Facebook message to a friend and he picked me up and took me to a meeting.
Oh, wow.
And that's kind of how it all.
Yeah. And it's, and in that moment, even though you had played, you know, all these big shows and everything, but in that moment when you felt like where you were and you were like, yeah, and you, your buddy takes you to a meeting, you couldn't have imagined like your life looking like it looks today.
Not in the least. I mean, even within 6 months, things were much better. You know, I had like a little job and stuff, and I was going back to school, taking one English class, college writing too, which I had dropped a million, you know, but again, like I thought music was over. You know, I had this deep-seated dream to maybe do some acting, maybe some voiceover type stuff, you know, but I just never could have imagined that, like, I would be sitting where I am right now in an apartment. I got married with a wife who's awesome and, like, you know, I was able to quit my like day job and now just do media type stuff full time and also do music and all this. Yeah. So yeah, like I think things, I do believe in that sense of like, or the whole like things happen when they're supposed to type deal. I think I'm still figuring out the faith stuff for me. But yeah, I definitely, when I've been ready to receive these gifts or whatever, you know,
right.
I've, you know.
Yeah. I think it's so true. I used to be like, I was the drunk who sat on a bar stool going like, I'm going to write a book, you know? Yeah. And then I got sober and wrote a book. Like it's you. And even though we've achieved these things, this level of success, and it all looks like, you know, we've accomplished all this stuff, it's a whole next level when we are actually present and show up for it.
Yeah. No, and yeah. Then inside, you know, and again, it's not that I just came out of a I'll be honest, you know, after this King of the World thing came out, just like any other creative project with people like us, you're like, the fuck am I going to do now, man?
Right.
Like, what could I, you know? So, and it was the end of the year and it's like cold, it's Boston. Yeah. So, and I was a little bummed out the last couple of weeks, but I've, you know, trying to hit the ground running. I just today signed up for like a trainer, you know, doing this like new. I work out. It's actually a big part of my recovery, but I've always been like, you know, I should get a trainer to like tell me what to do type thing. I just need some of this accountability.
Yeah.
So I just today, I just fucking agreed to do this. So hopefully I'll stick to it for the next 3 months or so.
I'm totally with you. I remember that. Tell me what to do and I'll do it. You know?
Yeah. 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 That's the, you know, that's the part of the 12 step stuff, which is understanding that it can be a little,
right.
Maybe, you know, but like the accountability aspect, the just getting out of your head, the service element too is so important. You know, you don't at the, because you just, for me, I felt like, what could I possibly have to offer to the world, you know, on January 5th or, you know, which was at that time, my parents' wedding anniversary. It was about to be my sobriety anniversary. I didn't know that, but like, you know, what could I, cause you're so stuck in yourself.
Right.
So, but you don't, you know, you just give a ride to somebody if you have a car or like, so these types of things.
Yeah.
Are so important.
And it touches on something that I want to close with, but I wanted to be sure to talk about with you because it was so powerful to me. Like one of the key takeaways I got was your discussion of the essential nature of empathy. And you describe empathy really beautifully. And I wonder if we could finish with hearing from you a little bit about empathy and what it means and what it brings.
Yeah, I think just the ability to like, to be able to put yourself in somebody else's, you know, shoes. I think and I'm sorry, it's been a few months since I wrote that script. So I'm like, what the hell did I say?
Ideas on empathy. No need to quote that.
Yeah. And I'm sure the psychiatrist in episode 7 probably said it much better than I did. That was a real treat to have a Muslim mental health professional on episode 7 of our show. But but empathy, the idea that like, because you can't, It does, I think, start with the self-love, you know, to be able to empathize with others. Is that kind of what you were hoping I would say? I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, please. No apologies. No, this is awesome. Yeah, like the ability to realize for me when I got sober, like it helped me to accept myself. You know, I was so used to like beating myself up about everything and how terrible I was while I was trying to put this perfect facade out in the world. Yeah. And getting sober and really, you know, learning to have some compassion for myself and to put that back down that I was beating myself up with and to accept that I'm human and I show up and do the best I can, you know, in the context I've been given. And that's the, you know, that's what I try and do in any situation. That allowed me to look at somebody else, at the next person who I might've just been like, oh, you're an asshole. I don't have time for this to be like, to think about like what is happening with that person, you know, or what is, you know, or things that I would sort of shrug off as that doesn't sound like such a big deal. It is a big deal. And it's all a matter of, you know, perspective and just empathy, just like not, it goes back to what we were talking about before. Like there's no judgment. There's no stigma. We're all just humans trying to do the best we can.
I'll tell you a story about empathy. Actually, this might be a good last thing to tell you. So after the show came out, obviously I got messages from people from all walks of life, including old friends I hadn't seen, talked to in maybe 20, 30 years. So one friend, she reached out. She loved it. She said she just wanted to catch up and have dinner. I hadn't seen her since the end of high school. And I've known her since pre-K even, like kindergarten and before. And she was like, anyway, so we go out to dinner with her and her her husband, who is in recovery. And he starts, one of the first things he says to me in the first 5 to 10 minutes is, listen, I want to tell you something. I voted for Trump. Ooh. My father voted for Trump. And I listened to your podcast and I related to it primarily because of the recovery stuff, but I had never in my life, met like a Muslim or brown person, you know, and initially I was like, really, dude? But I was able to put that, this is somebody that if I'm dead honest with you, like I had no interest in, in reaching this type of person, right?
Yeah.
Like I'll be totally honest about that. But he said that to me, and he said that I called my father after the first episode of your show, and I talked to him about this stuff and like, hey, maybe like this isn't cool, like when we make these jokes and stuff, and like, you know, and so I just want you to know that like you have literally changed a person's opinion.
Amazing.
So that was pretty,
that
fucking,
is huge.
That was some empathy right there.
Yeah. And that, yeah, all over that. That is amazing. Yeah. And, you know, I can't recommend it enough. The podcast is incredible. King of the World. We're going to put links in the show.
Thank you for like listening to it. And, you know, because it's not always something that you do interviews and people, maybe you're like, okay, you listen to the trailer. That's cool. You know, everybody has time. And I know. Yeah. But I appreciate it.
Well, I wouldn't have, but for I got completely sucked into it. You know what I mean? I would have done diligence on it
and
listened a little really here and there, but I wouldn't have been like, I need to hear this start to finish. And I started, I texted Tawny immediately. I was like, I just started the podcast. I'm in. I'm done.
Amazing.
I'm fully loaded. So it really is incredible and I recommend it to everyone. And it has just been an honor to have you on. Thank you.
It's an honor for me to do, because I've been doing so many the press, I guess, around this, and I wanted to do like the recovery stuff, you know. So this is the first like recovery podcast I've obviously, like I've told my story on a couple of different ones, but it's really cool to like be on like a recovery focused podcast.
That's great. Well, I hope you'll come back when Tawny's here.
Anytime.
And we can all talk.
Anytime.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Shah Jahan. And
thank you, Lisa.
We'll see you guys next time. Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard. If so, please hit subscribe and consider rating and reviewing us so others can find us. Tawny, how can our listeners find you?
You can find me at Tawny M. Lara on all of the social medias. You can find my blog, sobrietyparty.com. Lisa, how can we find you and your amazing book?
My book is Girl Walks Out of a Bar, and it is available at bookstores everywhere and online. And you can find me at lisasmithadvisory.com. And I'm on social media at Girl Walks Out. Thanks for listening.